Welcome to Dominate for Two, a War Machine and Hordes podcast.
I'm Alex.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Benjamin.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to podcast anymore.
Well, apparently Mark, being the only person here who didn't have donuts this morning, is having a bad day.
God damn it, Daniel. You're
You've ruined
everything.
Our podcast forever.
Get the fuck out of this apartment. You are not welcome here. Okay, right. Cash me outside. How about that? No. We're sticking with this. There's no cutting. There's no re-recording. We're just doing it live.
Yeah,
and that's ruined.
Yeah,
forever.
You go upstairs.
Didn't you see the light we had outside that said recording on air? Oh my god.
Okay, what were we doing before we were rudely interrupted?
I think we should restart
the
intro.
We fucked it up. We're just blaming Dan.
No. We're sticking with this. There's no redos. This is real life.
And I'm Benjamin, and this is our terrible revisiting of a really good topic.
But it doesn't matter how you start. It matters how you finish, Ben. And I always finish strong.
And I always finish the same way.
All right.
We're gonna
redo intros.
No, this is going
post-credits.
I'm vetoing
this
that. No. No, we're sticking with this.
I'm Alex.
No.
He is Alex. You can't fake news that.
Oh my god.
Okay, let's just go into the beatdown. We're sticking with this.
And I'm Alex.
I'm Alex.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Alex.
And today we're talking about a topic we actually covered previously on this show. And unfortunately, the original recording was lost due to just a bunch of technical problems with it. But we're coming back to it because this is a hugely salient point for the War Machine community. We're talking about a seminal Magic the Gathering article called Who's the Beatdown? And the implications for playing War Machine.
And full credit to the gentleman who wrote the article, Mike Flores, who wrote a bunch of excellent articles on Magic Tactics.
That's the OG article, right? We're largely talking about the revisited article, who is a different author.
Also
shout that gentleman out.
Yes. These are, in case you're wondering, these are all Magic the Gathering articles, which are obviously a different game than the game we are podcasting about, but there are a lot of overlaps with both the concepts and the strategy involved and, of course, how to look at things. Obviously, many of us here on the podcast played competitive Magic as well, and so we're exposed to these articles at the time. I, being a bit older, was actually exposed to them in their current form.
When they were contemporary.
I mean, I was playing when the Revisited article came out. That was right around the time that I quit playing competitive Magic.
Right. But I do remember reading his articles, the original articles at the time, when I was really getting into Magic back in 99. But we've alluded to this actually in a number of our episodes as well, because we continue to forget that we never actually posted this episode and we referred to it on a couple of occasions. So in order to make it seem less silly, we're actually going to go over this, and hopefully the machine here will be kind to us and Alex won't delete all this in a fit.
Maybe this is a cursed topic, and it will never be recorded appropriately.
Yeah, we're off to a great start with this one.
We're having magnificent donut conversations.
Don't put that evil on me. Like, that's all the fault of the gremlin upstairs.
Hey, you live here. It's your fault.
All right. Ben, how about, because you have a really firm grasp of the Magic angle, how about you take us through just like sort of a highlights overview and who's the Beatdown is about in Magic?
So back in 99, when this first came out, I mean, I'll be honest, when I first started playing Magic, I didn't even understand there was a tactic to the game, right? Like, it was, you put cards together, you drew out cards, you had a good time, right? And I remember, because of course, I've always been a convention goer. I used to go for RPGs. I started going for 40K back when it was a meaningless game at a convention, except you were just rolling dice and having a good time. Magic was the first game I ever went to a game con and played competitively. Like, it was just simply the first thing that came up that was like that. And I remember going there, and I thought I was making perfectly fine decks. Like, I thought I was like, oh yeah, my Curd Ape Fireball Mountain deck was the best thing ever seen, right? And I did very mediocre in the tournament. And I was surprised by that because of the six people I was playing Magic with at the time, I was clearly the better Magic player. And then I kind of thought to myself, huh, like this is not true. Clearly, definitively provable that I was not the best Magic player. And in fact, my deck performed so badly versus some of the other people that I felt like there was some core thing I was actually missing from the game. And so then I went out, and there was this magazine at the time called The Duelist, and I believe the original article was linked from there, or because I remember reading the original article, but I can't remember if it was in The Duelist or if it was on the website. But that's really what turned me on to how to make a Magic deck, like the construction, the blend of mountains versus utility cards versus attack spells and all the other fundamental mechanical building issues with the deck and what you're trying to do with it. And one of the concepts that was put in this article that really stuck with me was that in the article is called Who's the Beatdown? And he's identifying the type of players and how you have to decide to play the game once you're committed to the match. And that was really enlightening to me at the time because I never really considered that, right? You know, obviously I played chess, I liked miniature games, but these were things that weren't coming up in a competitive environment for me. And when he articulated the points, I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Like, I can tell right away when I need to make these decisions, and it impacted my performance in Magic tournaments a lot. And, you know, I obviously never became a runaway world champion, but I was much happier and I had a few wins that were, you know, very gratifying before I stopped chasing the dragon with buying thousands of dollars of Magic cards every month.
So the basic concept of that gives you all this is the supposition that there are two positions in the game. One player is the beatdown, and one player is the control, and control is already an existing term for a style of mechanics in War Machine. It's very important to break that out, which we'll get to later. But there's two positions, the beatdown and the control. The control player is basically attempting to stall the game indefinitely or prevent headway from being made against them, because in the long run, they will eventually win due to either, you know, controlling the board with a minor lead or having a bigger draw advantage and just, you know, letting your opponent burn their, you know, all their steam and then finish them off. And you have the beatdown player, who is the player who is not in the position of long run winning the game and needs to make something shift and accelerate toward a win condition as quickly as possible to blow through before your opponent builds up.
Right. And the point of this article was to correctly identify who was the beatdown in any given match, because control players can be required to become the beatdown in order to win the game. And recognizing that inflex point of role reversal is the core competency in determining whether or not you're actually playing the game to the scenario correctly, in my opinion.
Right, because the player who misidentifies their role, if their opponent identifies their role correctly, the person who misidentified their role is probably going to lose. Like, if you're playing like you're the control player, but when in reality your opponent is actually going to win in the long run, and he correctly identifies that, you're probably going to lose.
Yeah, you're just walking yourself down.
Right. And that's one of those things. And this is something that we talked about a lot when we were doing a lot of tournament prep in Mark II, because we were looking around and, you know, we had remembered this article and we'd looked at it again and realized how relevant it was to a lot of the War Machine planning. And it's one of those things when you are looking at your list selection, when you first sit down at the table, it's really important, if you're doing this, to ask yourself that question: who's the beatdown in this matchup? If you are playing what you feel is a control, and then you look at your opponent's list and realize that he has a better long-term attrition game, you have to switch to thinking, I'm the beatdown, because otherwise you will go into control and your opponent, who's stronger in that role, will then just win the game. And sometimes if you're the beatdown and you think of yourself that way and you're going into another list, you realize that you have a much higher chance if you switch to being control, because you'll take away components of what your opponent's list is supposed to be doing, which is not what you fundamentally built your list to do, but then gives you the game which you need to win with. And I'll use my Striker 2 list again as an example for that. So Striker 2 is normally the beatdown. Like, his goal is to deliver a lot of damage over a long distance consistently. You know, I have Cavalry. Striker 2 himself has an incredible threat radius with his feet and his ability to assassinate. But there's certain lists into which that is a terrible, terrible plan. And, for example, like going into the Child in Grimkin, the odds of Striker personally assassinating the Child are really, really low. So normally I would call myself the beatdown, but if I see a list like that, or, for example, into, you know, like a Menoth attrition list, or, you know, some of the troll lists, or any of those kind of lists that would give me a lot of fuss, I would have to change from being what I perceive to be the beatdown into being the control, so that I can use my high offense to segment the board out and try to win on scenario while keeping my caster safe. And if I correctly identify that, then the game is clearly winnable by me. But if I just declare myself the beatdown every single time and go for the assassination, or go to just try to rip through the army, and I'm not the beatdown, I'm going to lose every one of those games.
Also, I think some people don't realize that the beatdown and control roles can change in the middle of the game.
Yes.
If something unexpected happens. So, for example, I was playing the Grim One huge base list that's been in vogue into Locke Crucible Guard, and they surprised me by being able to clear off one of my war wagons and land a redlined Vulcan into my Sea King. And because she has precision strike, she just took out my spirit with a no healing aura on the Sea King. Now, I'm in the beat. I was in control beforehand because I had like put a lot of assassination threat onto her. She was like on nothing. And I was going to just like walk her down from there. But because he had basically just ensured that the only threat to the Vulcan could literally never handle it, because it can't buy attacks anymore. I basically turned into a beatdown, and I basically had to drop everything for a low odds assassination.
That's, yeah, roll, it, you identify it at the outset, but roles can reverse. And that's actually one of the, you know, one of the principal ways of, if you are the beatdown player, someone who needs to wrest the momentum of the game from your opponent, it doesn't have to be winning immediately, like burning them down with a mono red deck in Magic. It can be just, I am going to wrest the control position from them. Like, going back to our concrete endgame situations and winning the game from our previous episode, you know, the person whose goal is to just end turn 7 with the most points, that's a strategy a control player will typically be following. And the beatdown, the person who identifies, I am the beatdown, if we go 7 rounds, I am not likely to have the most points. You have to consult what will either appropriately rest this momentum or what will close the game out well before then. And that could be like assassination, that could be just blitzkrieging scenario and sacrificing for attrition. Or it could be you're the person with the army that, if pieces are trading at an accelerated rate, can just burn through them really quickly and, you know, cause your opponent to lose stuff in the chaos.
And also, I think that by identifying correctly, it can help determine the level of aggressiveness you need to be playing the army with. Because a control player generally can play a lot more conservative. Correctly identifying control player can generally play more conservatively, try to be the person who's giving up the least in piece trading positions, and sort of bunker in a way that allows them to get points up and avoid contesters getting near things. Whereas if you're correctly identifying as the beatdown, you realize that you don't have that luxury. Like, you have to aggressively move in and attempt to remove units or solos or whatever is required to gain momentum on scoring and or assassination threats. And sometimes, like if you have an assassination army, sometimes you have to turn that on to remove a non-warcaster piece, because normally anything that's capable of assassinating warcaster is also capable of removing heavy. And sometimes you just have to identify as the beatdown player, like, I got to take care of this heavy on this side of the board, because if I leave it alone or don't spend my resources on it, that heavy is going to cost me the game in the long term, because that control player will just keep denying me scoring. And then you have to choose to burn your beatdown resources on a not optimal target to ensure the control player doesn't have the advantage. And that can be hard sometimes, because people are rarely that enthused about popping an assassination feat to take off a heavy, right? Like, it just feels like a waste sometimes. But sometimes that's exactly the right play, because, you know, there's a lot of armies that have like that one really hard to shift heavy that they kind of throw off into a corner. And, you know, the question they're asking you is like, okay, I have this control. I have, you know, an arm 20, you know, 28 to 32 box thing over here. What are you going to do about it? Like, there's no offense, but removing it becomes a huge issue. And sometimes the beatdown player, you're like, no, I just got to throw damage at it till it's gone. Now I'm claiming this side of the board, and those pieces are gone from this side, and now I can score. And, you know, you take those pieces from the control player.
Yeah. I think this is a really good opportunity to split out control the war machine technical term from control the beat down Magic.
Yeah,
the
we
Gathering
don't want another sweeper pivot situation on our hands, or I swear to God, I will bleed from my eyes.
Yeah, so
we'll video that if it happens. By the way,
so control in this context refers to player role, what kind of victory condition you are chasing, typically a long slow win, or typically have your opponent spend all their force and then attrition them down or score out on scenario. I think for purposes of this analysis, it's most useful to start at turn 7, I win on points, because that's most clearly, you will only attempt to do that if you are currently the control player.
Right. Yeah, and control, in my mind, when I talk about it at War Machine, is always very clearly control of the scoring rhythm is really how I would put it the most, because that's what you're controlling in the game. You've built an army to control the scoring rhythm so that you're always in the lead, regardless of whether you started first or second, and forcing your opponent to do something about it. And that gives you that control, because you're controlling the pace of the game.
So a list that I would consider almost always being control when it gets put down on the table is Harbinger. Mm-hmm. Because it's very hard to stop her from contesting zones, and it's very hard to get an attritional advantage on her. And one of the easiest ways to deal with her is being able to pull off an assassination of some kind, which is traditionally a beatdown move.
Yeah, yeah. Harbinger's goal is run down the... It's not even running it down on points. It's, you're going to run out of guys faster than me. Like, I've beaten a Cephalix army with, you know, almost triple the body count on attrition with Harbinger. You know, it... Yeah, she is playing almost always from a control position. And in a lot of ways, like, the control role, you know, because Harbinger has actually her feet, but other than that, very few, you know, what we would call technical control, war machine control abilities. So what that looks like, you know, and when people say control in the technical, like, abilities and effects war machine sense, often centers on board area denial, partial activation denial, like things that will let your opponents use their pieces less in a generalized way. So like blinding models, knocking them down, Haley's feet reducing their activation, Kruger just denying areas of the board by physically moving models out of it.
And very often those elements actually get you into a control state on the board.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's really important not to conflate them, though, because, you know, partial activation denial or things like that can be really important to running a beatdown strategy, especially if you're doing beatdown assassination, which I want to get into later.
Yeah, because Haley, too, used to be famous for that. You'd use the feat to stop your opponent from getting retribution on what you were assassinating with. Right. So you get another turn of assassination. Like, that's why that feat was so backbreaking for a long time.
Yeah, like, I make a run at you, and you cannot escape if I fail. Now we're going to do it again.
Yeah, exactly. That's what made her old feat so crazy good, was that it always gave you two turns of assassination, essentially.
Yeah. So there is an example of, like, what people consider technical control abilities not matching up with a control play style is Adeptus Ron. Ron quacks like a control caster. He walks like a control caster. He smells like a control caster. He is not a control caster.
Beatdown.
Yeah, Ron is one of the most intense beatdown casters in the game. And while he has abilities like Polarity Field or Telekinesis that you'd usually associate with denial, he's not very well suited to that. And if you actually watch Ron play on attrition, his toolkit isn't very good for it. Like, trying to play a long, drawn-out game, Ron frequently loses. But his toolkit is amazing for ending a game as fast as possible by either clearing models out of an area with a lot of movement support in the army or just assassinating. And he's legendary for being able to get you almost anywhere, but he's constantly playing to end the game as fast as possible.
Side note, we haven't seen the CID yet, but just on a snap call of being able to take battle mages as a free benefit in Forges of War, do you think there's going to be a big resurgence of Ron?
If they let you increase the field allowance. I mean, that was my bag in Mark II, but...
That list in Mark II was amazing, by the way. Yeah.
But even still, if you get to take... They're FA2?
Yeah, they're 2.
But still, two free sets of battle mages? Like, sure, they die way easier, but... For Ron's output purposes?
I think they would help a lot with that.
Especially if you go up to like max on Magisters as well. But it's interesting. Well, so Ron has this kit that's very much one way. You put the Helios in, it actually gives him a very strong attrition game, which he can parlay into a control style game. There's two ways to build Ron now. I still think the beatdown is probably where he wants to be most of the time. But like it varies. And I'll give you like a couple odd for instances. So I have a huge amount of experience with Ron in Mark II, particularly running Charge of the Battle Mages, where I had 5 units of Battle Mages. They all got advanced move. I had 5 Magisters. They all got advanced move. And then I had a couple of Jacks. And my goal was, I'm going to grab your caster. I'm going to move him 36 inches. And at the end of that, he's going to be dead. I had... a game against a Protectorate player running the Avatar and Severius II and a bunch of other things. Like, I couldn't realistically get his... He had the Covenant, too. I couldn't realistically get his caster with spells or abilities, so my traditional beatdown was denied to me. But it was a very wide scenario that had a good points payout. I just shoved Battle Mages into the zone and... This is a beatdown move, but it doesn't follow the traditional assassination. He would walk models in, kill a bunch of battle mages, and then the battle mages would activate and just beat back models out. And I would just score, you know, SR 2012, like I score 1 point, I score another point, I score another point. That's it. But I had to identify that specific vector as my vector to win quickly, because also long run, there was no way I was killing his army. Another, for instance, I had a game against Joe Oliveira with Lilith 2, who is also, and this is where the Who's the Beatdown article and talking about identifying your role is really important in a War Machine context. Lilith 2 is another, or was another, beatdown caster. She would not win a long run game on attrition against most opponents. Because if you can actually weather her fire, and if you were playing competitively at that point, you would probably design to do that and not get your caster killed. You would just run her down. So Lilith, very aggressive beatdown caster at the time. Ron, very aggressive beatdown caster at the time. We get into a match with the two of them. And Joe actually was the control player in that situation. He can't kill very many battle mages, but the battle mages do almost no work to him, given ubiquitous stealth at range and all these things. But, you know, he was still trying to go in and get me, and that actually made my job of getting him much easier, because I was in the position where I wasn't going to do a bunch of work just having this standoff shooting match, and I needed to end that game fast. It's possible in a different configuration I would be the control, but like when you misidentify your role, especially if both of you are playing lists where you're used to playing from a control position, you know, if you misidentify the role, that'll end up with one of you getting just walked down super fast. Like This is particularly visible in armies that both want to play attrition control, because one of you is going to do it better to the other than one of you, and you really need to know which one of you that is.
Yeah, and I would say my experience recently with the new polished Gators Maelok is very much that, because Maelok is, in the current meta, very much a control-built caster. He doesn't have the spell list that makes it look like he's a control caster, but his whole shtick is controlling the scoring rhythm with his model count, because he has a lot of models on the table, he has a lot of scoring opportunities, and he has a lot of denying people from getting into zones by having a bunch of hard-to-remove models in the way. And that's the game plan. So most Maelok players, you put your army on the table, your plan is to deliver a turn 7 win and stop your opponent from scoring you out or assassinating Maelok. But sometimes you'll run into an army that's better at that than you are. Zadesh, I mean, there's plenty of examples in Scorn, especially with Scorn's theme benefits of takedown. Troll champs are an exemplar of things that are bad for Gators.
Actually, I have a really good example of this. When I played Brett Fogle at LVO, I feel pretty strongly I was in the control position with my Madrak list. I was inevitably going to win, especially once I was able to clear zone and start scoring before he did. But he recognized that he needed to change what was going on, and he managed to mortality snacking my Creel Stone, and an entire flank collapsed. And by the end of turn 7, I think he was up by 1 CP.
Yeah, that's...
Admittedly, he probably could have gotten another couple, I think, by virtue of the fact that... He basically just auto-passed when he realized he had won, but...
He could have made it a bigger lead, but the fact of the matter was...
But yeah, I was in a winning position where if something didn't change, we were going to maintain parity. And he gets my Creel Stone, because he saw an angle that I really didn't, because I wasn't used to people coming after my Creel Stone like that. And he was able to completely turn around a matchup that I think was... pretty slam dunk for me, because it turns out Pal 14 Weapon Masters will chew through champs like, or not champs, gators like they're nothing.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, and that's, I mean, and I think that identifies a very successful pivot, because he realized he had to become the beatdown in order to win that matchup. Whether, you know, he obviously wasn't thinking of it that way, but I mean, that's what happened, because he recognized you had the better control. And, you know, that's one of those keystone abilities when you're running a list like that, because I've had to go for a desperate assassination with Maelok before, because I realized very quickly I wasn't control anymore. Like, either something had happened, like I'd lost some heavies unexpectedly, or the board state did something in a way that I hadn't really thought through before it started happening. And this happens especially with the CAD model changes and the rules and some other things I've been hitting. And it was kind of like I looked at the state and went, wow, like, I'm definitely losing this by turn 7. There's no way I'm not pulling this out. So you instantly flip to the, like, okay, how do I kill what matters to win the game now? Because if I already know I'm losing at turn 7, the preservation of my caster becomes far less important, because I've already lost the game in that state. I have to then do something to deliver a win. And, you know,
if you give your opponent a 40%er when they already have 100%er on running down the turn limit, it's actually bad for them to take it.
Right, exactly. And so that's one of those things where I've pulled out games like that because my opponent didn't recognize that I had made that shift. And, you know, plenty of them have failed, but, you know, in my math, I was like, well, I've already lost. Like, this game is already my opponent's. And
you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Yeah, exactly. And so...
Michael Scott.
I would, you know, like, it's one of those things where at least being able to recognize that meant that I didn't just burn down the turns in a state where I was already losing. Because I've done that before, too, where I thought that I had it, and then I realized something. I'm like, oh, no, I never had this game. Like,
yeah, you get three pieces deeper, and your opponent has one more heavy and two more solos than you, and you're like, didn't see this coming, really should have.
Yeah, and an interesting side effect of switching rules like that, too, can be sometimes it has an impact on your opponent's perception of where the game's going. Because I've noticed before, when I made that switch and become really aggressive, my opponent can sometimes misread what I'm doing. Because they may have misidentified their role. Suddenly I'm becoming aggressive and they think to themselves, oh God, he's got something in the back burner that they didn't account for, which can then make them less aware of the scoring rhythm, which then puts me back into a control position. Obviously, into better players, most of the time they just sort of shrug and then kill me and, you know, good game. But there, you know, there's definitely been times where that's pivoted a game that I was losing into a game I could win.
Pivot. Paradigm.
No, that's actually an appropriate use, but yeah. Oh boy. And that really speaks to misidentifying, like, flummoxing a control, someone who is sitting in the control seat and causing them to lose sight of that. Like, your goal as the control player is generally don't lose, don't lose, don't lose, don't lose, don't lose. And then after that, like, stall down the game as much as possible. This is actually like where, and the original article goes into like, okay, issues of combination. It is sometimes possible for a player to both be beat down and control, and that's when their opponent is really screwed. Like when you've wrested the ability to make both kinds of moves completely away from them. But this isn't like this varies on matchup to matchup, table to table, and scenario to scenario. So it's not like some holy grail you should aspire to be beat down control, but it's an odd situation that arises sometimes.
Yeah, and that definitely happens the most when, and I've done this before, where let's say I go in for a piece trade, right? Because I recognize that I'm the beatdown at the start. I go in for a piece trade, and let's say my dice just go totally fuego. And I end up taking out more pieces than I had even begun to expect I would. And suddenly it flips because I have the beatdown advantage because it wasn't a piece trade. It was just a piece taking all of a sudden, which I hadn't expected. And then suddenly, not only do I have a side I wasn't expecting to have, but I still have all of my threat vectors on the table. And Nemo 3 used to be super egregious for this kind of thing where, you know, like I would just randomly remove a heavy from lightning leaps that I hadn't expected to get, completely changing the matchup profile. And then my opponent's like, huh, okay then. And you still have the assassination from the spark node. And, you know, like people realize that you're controlling the scenario rhythm and you are also still the beatdown. And it becomes a really dominant scenario at that point for the person.
Yeah, and like I ran into this fairly frequently with Sorsha 1, you know, because she's got this massive overawing assassination that's just really potent against a lot of casters. That's been changing lately, but she has this super potent, super long-ranged assassination, and that can just shove, if they you know, don't want to take the risk of losing on that, that will pull them way out of the game. And then Sorsha's also got all this technical control where, like, freeze your heavy, disrupt it, freeze that unit, like, grievous wound the spirit out of that guy. And, like, she has a toolkit where she can take this strong beatdown strategy, push you way out into the you are trying to not lose, but she's also in full control of the rhythm. So you can't, like, you're not the control. She's the control. And you have no access to beatdown. You know, those sorts of binary matchups, like sometimes it's people just not built to handle technical control, or sometimes it's just a bad matchup. Yeah. But it's a situation that shows up. And because Sorsha 1 has both of those, you know, back when I was playing her very heavily, I had to make the choice, like, am I going to, you know, when it wasn't a bad matchup or ludicrously advantaged for me, it was, am I going to attempt to stall them out and win on scenario because they can only move a limited set of their pieces at a time? Or am I going to be throwing absolutely everything into putting their caster in one spot where I can kill it?
Yeah, and I think that's also, I mean, there's a certain dynamic, too, between factions where some factions are simply victimized by other factions having a caster and list combination that always grants the advantage faction basically control and beatdown. And of course, those are the factions that tend to fall out of competitive play because they may have that new, a smaller swath of combinations, but if those combinations aren't popular, then they just become more likely to become victimized.
That's another Kador problem.
So yeah, actually, because I was getting in an argument with a forum, I looked this up. Kador has, since the beginning of 2018, Kador has 5 DGI placements, and 2 of them are from a team event. Krix has 32. Signar has over 20. And, like, those are, like, 2 of the major problem matchups for Kador right there. Mm-hmm. So, like, it kind of, like, crystallizes the picture of why Kador's in such a problem spot right now. Because, like, up until, what, like, a year ago, like, Lock and Load 2017, Krix wasn't seeing any play. Grimkin literally didn't exist. And Signar was in a very weird place where you had to rely on Kane 3.
I had that
and
list.
I think Kador had a pretty decent game into Kane 3.
Kador, yeah, Kador was... That was actually a strong time for Kador.
Yeah, Kador actually had... At the time, I believe that the Irisk 2 list was the single best counter in the game to Kane 3.
Kador was doing great, and then SR17 kicked in, Theme Forces dropped later, and it's been bad times.
Well, at that point, you had virtually all of the Theme Forces you have now. The only ones you didn't have was Wolves of Winter and the Man of War theme, which are arguably two of the least played ones you guys have. Well, I guess Man of Wars are gaining popularity now. But
yeah, total digression. Kador has had a problem with, like, oh, these guys steal our momentum and our position that we really want from us.
And they're really overrepresented at top tables, which is super nuts.
Yeah, and again, it comes down to Kador is disadvantaged for being control and beatdown in all those matchups because they don't have the profile required to deliver the beatdown, and they don't have the resources required to play control properly. And, you know, and Rhett suffers to this from a lesser degree, but definitely suffers from it. And minions used
well,
to have
won't
it.
Be suffering from it by the time this airs. The CID's hopefully. On Wednesday, right?
I don't know.
But I mean, this is a thing that, for example, minions used to suffer from tremendously, which has been mostly solved by the new model releases. And it's just one of those things that if you don't have the choices, you can't pick a role properly. And, you know, that's, and again, it comes down to identifying, and this is why people shift factions as well. And honestly, if you're a serious tournament player, you know, we've had this conversation before in previous episodes, but you really just have to recognize that sometimes you have to shift factions to pick the faction that has the best overall choices for beating down and controlling. And sometimes it's hurtful because I really love my Man of War. And I honestly do. I mean, I have 47 of the things. I mean, 47 of the bleeping things. And I really like the models. I like the concept. And they've been terrible forever. And it makes me sad because that's a lot of models sitting in a cupboard somewhere in my house. Whereas, you know, I've been shifting factions. And now, obviously, I own a bunch of stuff, so it's not really a huge issue. But it's one of those things where I'm shifting not because I'm bored, it's because I can't win with what I'm running. And it's not like, you know, I'm like not the world's most amazing, but I think I'm a pretty damn competent player. And I'm hitting matchups where I'm left with neither being the beatdown nor the control in a reliable manner. And I see those matchups constantly. And so you have to think to yourself, well, if the range game has basically been destroyed, which it really has been with the changes to Krix and, you know, the trolls and the scorn and all the other stuff. So my Signar range thing only threatens people that aren't really threatening to win the tournament in the first place at this point. And I don't have enough magic weapons to handle the Krix thing. Suddenly I have to look at, well, what am I bringing? You know, like, what list makes sense with these factions? And, you know, it starts flipping you back. You're like, well, what I really need is a fast melee beater list. And, well, at this point, does Signar deliver that? I'm not sure they do. And you look at what's coming up, too, with Crucible Guard, which I think are going to be an amazing problem for the current Signar builds. And you think to yourself, wow, so there's a faction running a better synergizing range game than I can pull now. And how am I beating them?
It's funny because, like, recently I've actually had, and I think that's exactly the kind of, because it does, it's control versus beatdown is not all about list composition. Like, that's far from the only factor. It's once you're committed to a game, identifying it. But you can see patterns in the kinds of matchups you expect to hit and who takes what role and are you able to fulfill on it effectively. Yeah. And some factions have a harder time than others, and it may be because of prevalence of strong counters or whatever. I've actually had, like, basically the obverse experience from yours. You know, the whole Kador into Scorn transition was, this isn't working, let me try this other thing. But now, as I'm transitioning into Protectorate, like, Scorn has a robust toolkit. It can play in a variety of ways. I don't find myself having problems with it. And I, you know, Protectorate goes through our CID and Harbinger gets her changes and, like, this seems like an astonishingly strong, like, incredibly strong control plan that's very hard to stop and really easy to play yourself.
Magic, like, 12 inches, baby.
Yeah, like, I'm just going to move into this and see how far this goes. You know, because it comes out of the gate, it is overtly incredibly strong at playing the control position, and the list I'm playing is designed basically to, you know, as much as possible, minimize the possibility for a beatdown assassination, which is, Mark, unless you had anything on this, that's something I'd like to segue into to close out the episode. Okay, so beatdown assassination, it's often not enough to present, like, an overt assassination range. And, like, this is, you know, when I was in the control beatdown seat with Sorsha, this is why I assassinated so little in reality, is, you know, I can put together a bunch of numbers, my opponent can put together a bunch of numbers, and this is how far away you have to not be assassinated. You know, you may sucker punch people every once in a while, but, like, playing at a really refined and developed level, you have to anticipate that on some level your opponent's going to be able to see the assassination coming. So if you're the beatdown and you're trying to win through assassination, it's not enough just to have good range. As long as it doesn't push them completely out of the game, like, you've really got to get them to commit to a position where you can kill them. So line of sight mentioned another chess concept, which I found, like, oh yeah, that's dead on the money, actually, is the rule of three. Like, in chess, to get a checkmate in the mid game or in, you know, certain late game situations, you often need three power pieces to successfully pin the enemy king. In War Machine, their notion is that you basically need three things to pour enough firepower onto a caster to get it dead. And, you know, a lot of assassination runs are constructed at uneven ranges such that you often can't do that. Or you need to, like, to get all your pieces to converge at once. Or you need to do something to make your opponent spend resources so that you can get them with fewer pieces. In many ways, if you're doing beatdown assassination, it's almost like you're playing a fake game with your opponent. Like, you are very much trying to, like, as much as possible, make it look like you are going for attrition to get them to commit to a place that isn't safe. Or alternatively, give them your pieces, but make them spend resources on things like boundless charge, personal contributions from the caster, the need to move buffs, such that if, you know, if they answer you at these positions where you will lose things, they have to make themselves more vulnerable. And that can dramatically increase, like, the range of space where you can kill an enemy caster and how much or how little resources it will take you to kill them. So I'm trying to think of, like, a concrete example. Like,
well, Grima, the reason I've been playing her less and less and exploring other options is because she does have that fragility. Like, if you aren't in range of both Mulg and the Bomber, things kind of fall apart. And there's not enough of a long game there. Like, you're beat down. Like, you have control elements, but it's really hard to establish a control position when you don't have the scenario scoring capability.
Yeah. And, you know, you have a big battle group, and one of your big goals is to get your opponent to drag their entire army, including the back of their army, forward to where it's more gettable. You've got this big show of a large battle group, which can attrition, but, you know, you can run a game where you force their caster to compromise their safety, force them to spend resources. Like, there's plenty of casters that can survive one assassination run from Kolgrimma if they're camping three or four just on native focus, and you want to drop them down below that threshold because they have to overreach to get things like Mulg. Yep. Yeah, so I mean, that's only one way to win his beatdown, but like assassination really is the most common. You know, you can do it. I think in reframing the paradigm of control player, not just winning at 5 points like in 2016 and earlier, but the control player winning at the end of seven as their primary plan, also opens a lot of perspective for I can run accelerated scenario games like losing massively on attrition, but just get me there. Or get me so high up that I can spend the next two or three turns with no pieces just staying in and winning at seven.
I've had a lot of games with Madrak where I just run my Raiders up and jam with them. They're like 15, 16 tough steady. And it's like, you're not getting through this. I'm scoring on 1 to 2 elements on your turn two, my turn three. I'm up 4 points right now. Like, I can either try and find a way to clear one zone or like one other scoring element to try and win the whole thing, or I'm still in an up position and you still haven't touched my bears, you haven't touched my champs, you haven't touched my Glacier King. Like, what are you doing?
Right, yeah. And if you manufacture 4 points in a round, like, you would be perfectly happy to take all of those reserve attrition pieces and just shove them at your opponent, because it's like, you're not going to touch my geometry again. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. No, that's a strong control plan.
Well, that's the beatdown plan. Beatdown on scenario. Like, you know, you give them all your pieces, but you're going to win the scenario.
You end up in a control position.
Yeah, you end
by
up
using beatdown.
Yeah.
Which sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but like, I mean, like, we kind of talked about like killing a piece will like let it switch into control, but being able to shove your opponent into a board state where they can't score inevitably will start putting you in control until they do something, because now you're up on points. Yeah. You've limited their agency and the ability to score points. It's going in your favor. You're walking it down.
Right. If you assume the control player is the person who is currently positioned to be winning, like, yeah, beat down, you can end the game quickly. Alternatively, you can rest control, like we said earlier. And, you know, that will often, if you identify you are the beat down, you don't even necessarily need to look at assassination per se, though that can be an out. You can just look, how do I put myself in the control seat? I can be jamming on scenario. Actually, with my Zadesh list, I just learned over playing it a bunch, it almost always starts in the beat down position. Like, I have shorter threat ranges than you, et cetera, et cetera. And then I have my second turn just positioned to blunt my opponent's impact. So, like, you have to commit to a board position. You are going to roll off me. And then I'm going to come into you as hard as possible and absorb your impact again. But I start in beatdown. And the first order of business is position such that I will be control. And one of the things I discovered inside of that, you know, because it's something that's so easy to miss if you're not paying active critical attention to who is beat down in control, even across your career. One of the things I discovered out of that is, oh, that maneuver is much easier to do going second. Because going first, I have to have an awkward lurch turn where I have to position for no engagement and give up table space. Inside of being in this conversation of beatdown control, I discovered an absolutely game-changing thing for this list I've been playing for a long time. Anything else we want to hit on this topic?
No, I mean, that's pretty much just another tool in the toolbox if you're trying to figure out how to improve your game state and, you know, more consistent results.
Well, I will be sure to bork this one up in the exporting process, and
excellent.
We'll re-record it in another 6 months.
And we're going to refer to it constantly, though.
Oh, I guess quick little plug/reminder before we close out. This is going to be going on in a couple of weeks, so it'll be kind of close to the NorCal Classic. So Saturday the 4th, it'll be in Mountain View, California. This will be a wild card points qualifier, and the wonderful Tyson will be coming up from San Luis Obispo.
Hooray!
My number one favorite TO of all time.
And you shouldn't go, because it will be a great time, and we don't want you there.
That is hateful.
Aren't we the Hateful Podcast?
Did we become the Hateful Podcast when I wasn't paying attention?
Haven't we always been the Hateful Podcast?
Thank you for listening to Dominate for Two. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Got a question or an episode idea?
Email us at dominateforto.podcast@gmail.com.
We've had a number of hateful scandals over this last section of our run.
Oh, but like Red and Kador and Pivot.
That's just truth speaking.
Oh, we still haven't recorded an episode on that yet. I don't think anyone's talking about it anymore.
About
though.
What?
Pivot? No. There's apparently a podcast. I don't keep up with all the podcasts I need to, because like I've got so much time at work where I just listen to stuff. But I think we need to record an episode called Puck Pivots.
Puck Pivots, I like it.
I'm missing the reference here.
It's called a spoonerism.
You don't listen to any podcasts at all, do you?
No, I hate podcasts.
Okay.
That's why this is the hateful podcast.